Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Well, from day-to-day issues like remembering where you put your keys to those inescapable intrusive thoughts, to serious illnesses such as Alzheimer's and dementia, memory can be fragile and an elusive concept to understand. Here to discuss what happens with our memories and, most importantly, what we can do to have a healthy mind is Professor Shane O'Mara, Professor of Experimental Brain Research at the School of Psychology and Institute of Neuroscience in Trinity College, Dublin. Shane, you're very, very welcome.
Thank you, Dervil.
Listen, first things first, let's maybe go back to, I suppose, first principles. How are memories actually formed?
At its core, our memories are formed because there are long-term changes in the brain. And I think that kind of core principle underlies everything. The connections between your brain cells are referred to as synapses. And memories involve the strengthening of certain connections between certain synapses and occasionally even the loss of certain types of connections between certain types of synapses.
There are many, Shane, though, different types of memories, though, aren't there? You know, some of our memories are very, very sharp. Some are much, much more elusive, like even including phenomena like nostalgia and déjà vu. Let me see. We'll take a quick break as we just get Shane back up on the line.
Sorry, David, something happened there or we disconnected.
I don't know. I hope it wasn't a memory failure there that, that you forgot
maybe
you were
part
with
of the
me.
I
was just chatting there, Shane, just about, you know, that we have different types of memories because we can have very, very sharp or very, very distinct memories and then, you know, nostalgia or deja vu. So there's different sort of types of them.
Yeah, so there's lots of ways of thinking about how you can classify our memories. And probably the two simplest ways to think about it is in terms of explicit memory and implicit memory. So by explicit memory, I mean things that you can actually say out loud. What is your name? What did you do tomorrow? Or sorry, what do you intend to do tomorrow? What did you do yesterday? Those kinds of things. And they're easily articulable kinds of memories, and that's what we tend to identify memory as. But there are other kinds of memory. You know, it's very hard to tell somebody how to cycle a bicycle, even if you have learned to cycle a bicycle. Telling them to center their mass and get into a dynamic equilibrium with the environment is utterly useless advice. The same with, you know, telling somebody how to play the piano. Well, you sit down and you strike the keys in the following order. Those memories are kind of slow to acquire memories, and they're acquired through practice. And they're a different type of memory, and they depend on a different part of the brain to the kinds of memories that we usually mean in everyday life.
You have a Substack, which is it's an online newsletter, and it's called Brain Pizza. And there's lots of articles there about brain and memory. And one of the interesting topics that you have discussed is mental time travel. Can you explain what mental time travel actually is?
Yeah, so mental time travel is this kind of amazing concept that we're not really conscious of in our everyday lives because our memory works so normally. But we're sitting here together and we're talking about the topics that we're talking about. And I can switch. I can say, what are you going to do next week? And immediately you'll switch out of the center, this present moment you're centered in, and you'll tell me about what you're going to do next week. And then I can say to you, what is it that you did last week? Were you doing this show last Sunday? What did you have for lunch last Monday? Things like that. So you can slide along a mental timeline from the present to the past to the future. And it turns out really remarkably that the parts of the brain that are involved in making sure that you can remember things are also the same parts of the brain that allow you to travel forward and backwards in time. And what we see with patients who have amnesia is that they're kind of stuck in what's called sometimes a permanent present tense. They're not able to imagine next week, and they're quite bad at recalling last week. So sometimes they're referred to as having an episodic existence because you live in the current moment. And that's what the core of mental time travel is. It's, in fact, central also to your imagination.
You talk as well about the seven sins of memory. What are they?
Well, we should be aware that our memories fail, okay? And they fail in all sorts of ways all the time. And we're overconfident in the terms of the things that we can recall. Our memories are not like a video camera that you point at the event and you can replay the tape and you can see what happened. Instead, what happens is our memories are kind of subject to all sorts of problems. One is a very simple one, transience. You can recall things for a period of time and then you lose them. Can you recall the people that you were in school with at the age of 7? Maybe one or two, maybe one of your friends, or a couple of your friends, but really a lot of them have lost. So you lose memories over time. One that's very common is blocking. And this is where you have a memory on the tip of your tongue and you just can't get it. You're kind of stuck. It happens to us all the time. And the core of it is one memory interferes with another. And then there are other ones, you know, we're biased in our recall. And we can have pathological forms of these sins of memory. One is persistence. And this happens very commonly in post-traumatic stress disorder, where people have intrusive memories of terrible events that keep coming into their awareness. And they may even have not just the memory of it, but they might even have very intrusive visual images. They might have sounds. They keep revisiting what has happened to them in the past.
One of the sins that you mention is suggestibility. And, you know, you look at a lot of court cases where, and some convictions that have been overturned in respect of false memories. How are false memories created, or how does suggestibility interact with that?
Yeah, so false memories are actually surprisingly common. And it's for a very simple reason. We're very bad at understanding where the memory that we've got actually comes from. And this is because we have conversations all the time with other people. And these conversations tweak in all sorts of ways what it is that we remember. So the kind of classic demonstration of this was an experiment by Elizabeth Loftus in California, at the University of California, where she interviewed people and suggested to them that their parents had told them, or had said to her, that they had been lost in a shopping mall at the age of 7 or 8. And of course, this hadn't happened. But over a few conversations like this, people came to believe that indeed this event had happened. Why? Because somebody that you trust, your parents, somebody else that you trust, a scientist, told you that something happened at a particular time that you don't really remember terribly well. And guess what? It becomes incorporated into your memory. And this happens in ways large and small to us all the time.
And are some people more vulnerable to it? Like, is it because of that relationship of trust that you have with someone, or are some of us maybe more gullible than others? Or
I wouldn't use the word gullible, because that's kind of there's a pejorative kind of sense to that. But what we know is that when you're sleep deprived, you're much more likely to be suggestible. We know that if you're vulnerable in some way, this kind of suggestibility is something that can happen pretty easily. If you're young, you know, under the age of 18 or something, and you're subjected to intense questioning, suggestibility is much more likely to occur. So there are people for whom suggestibility is more likely, but it's got to do with things like whether or not they're sleep deprived, whether or not they've access to a lawyer who can look after them when they're being questioned, or, you know, those kinds of things.
What about this? This comes up between my sisters and I all the time, where we have different versions of the same events that happened to us in childhood. And we regularly kind of pick each other up going, that did not happen like that. You know, what are you talking about? And sometimes we have different, I suppose, memories or recalls often of the same events. Is that covered by one of your seven sins?
I suppose it's a kind of a mixture of them, because what you don't have is a contemporary account. You know, if you have a memory that you have differences between your sisters over, and somebody hasn't pointed a video camera at the particular event, it's going to be difficult for anyone to say that their version is absolutely the right one. You need some sort of contemporary evidence to be able to demonstrate that. And of course, when you're recalling things in memory, there's lots of other things going on. You want to win the argument in the conversation. You want your version to be taken to be true. And this might lead you in turn to tweak your own memory without you actually being conscious of the fact that you're emphasizing certain aspects of your recall.
Yeah. Another thing is, you know the way they say that somebody with a really, really untidy desk, it's a sign of genius or whatever. If someone is more scatterbrained and others have a more organized mind, is one necessarily better or worse than the other? Or do our brains just develop and form differently?
I think the answer there really about being scatterbrained really depends on the focus of attention, what you're paying attention to at that particular moment in time. There are people who find it very difficult to pay attention to any one thing, so they move around from one thing to another. But there are other people who are intensely focused. For example, maybe they're a brilliant mathematician trying to solve an equation and they're just not paying any attention to the world around them. So it really comes back to this issue of your kind of focus of attention.
One of the biggest things out at the minute is that AI and our dependence on devices and phones and screens of all dimensions is going to affect our ability to learn and to retain and form memories. Do you share those concerns? Or is there any evidential basis for that? You don't?
Yeah, no, okay. I'm not worried about these at all. I think what these technologies do, just like technologies like reading and writing, calculators and all abacuses and all of the other things that people have been worried about through the centuries, actually extend the range of our cognitive function. And what they actually do is offload some of the tedium. You know, so it's the case now we can do tremendously accurate calculations in fractions of a second that previously would have taken suites of people days, if not weeks or months, to actually crank through. So these can be a tremendous liberator of human potential if they're used right.
And all our younger people shouting in joy, they've got evidence now that can go back and say, do them no harm at all. Look what you've done for them, Shane. Can I move on to something that, and I'm sure many people also were similarly affected, but I was really struck this week by the broadcaster, Fiona Phillips, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at the age of 62, former ITV journalist and whose mother and father and uncle had dementia. But she discovered she had the disease a year ago after suffering months of brain fog and anxiety. And, you know, she's gone public on her diagnosis. Are we any closer to discovering the causes of memory loss and conditions such as Alzheimer's and dementia?
I think we have a pretty good idea that there's loss of brain tissue in at least two key brain areas, which I haven't named because I'm sure your listeners aren't neuroanatomists, but I will throw them out there. One is called the hippocampal formation, and this is a part of the brain that runs from about the top of your ear down to your temple. You have two of them, one on either side, and they're connected to another brain area called the anterior thalamus. And we know from lots of evidence that damage to the hippocampal formation or damage to the anterior thalamus causes amnesia. And it looks like from the brain imaging studies that are going on at the moment here in Ireland and in plenty of other places, that it's loss of tissue in the hippocampal formation in particular that causes the memory loss underlying Alzheimer's disease. The problem is, arresting that tissue loss and detecting it early enough is a really, really difficult problem.
Why is that?
So, because in the case of Alzheimer's disease, the biggest risk factor is actually age. The likelihood of getting it goes up as you go older. The numbers are something like one in, I think, five or six will have dementia at the age of 75.
According to the Alzheimer's Disease International, someone in the world develops dementia every 3 seconds. Like, if this is a major issue for all of us, and particularly Ireland, like many other countries, is experiencing, you know, a rapidly aging population. Is there a link between, or am I wrong on this, between hearing impairment and Alzheimer's? Does that have something to do with the brain you've referenced?
Yeah, so there's a really remarkable set of findings have come out over the last couple of years on the prevention of dementia. And I think one of the most important scientific papers that I've read in years was published by The Lancet in 2020. They published a paper on dementia prevention, intervention and care. And what they show in this paper is that about 40% of dementia cases can be prevented by public health measures of one description or another. So just to give you a couple for instances, a hearing loss in midlife turns out actually to be at the root of about, I think, 8 or 9% of cases of dementia. Identifying hearing loss in people through the course of midlife and taking steps to correct that turns out actually to be one of these remarkable findings in terms of the importance of reducing risk. And there are lots of others. Don't smoke. Don't be socially isolated. Be physically active. If you have hypertension, get it treated. Keep your alcohol consumption under control, less than the 21 units a week. Those kinds of things all matter enormously. And then there are other things that also matter.
Can I ask you just to bring you back actually about women? Because all women will eventually undergo menopause, and many women report increased forgetfulness, brain fog during that transition, perimenopause and menopause. And it's one of the that kind of those memory issues, while it's completely normal, can be very disorientating for women who are going through that. And they worry, and many of them worry that their brain's abilities are diminishing. Are they, or is that just a phase?
I think the best you can say is that that's a phase. And, you know, you have to look at the many older women in public life who continue to make enormous and amazing contributions at the highest intellectual levels to know that these kinds of worries are things that you don't need to worry about. The change in hormonal status at that age is inevitably going to cause some changes. But it is the case that you can confuse changes in memory that happen naturally across the course of the lifespan with something that happens to be going on acutely at a particular moment in time. And they may not have any relationship with each other.
I have a question, lots of questions coming in for you, Shane, but Kieran in Glasnevin says, hi Derval, will you ask Shane, does continuing learning, when you're talking about prevention, does continuing learning help keep conditions such as Alzheimer's at bay, that notion of keeping the brain active or fit as well as your physical fitness?
That's a really important variable right throughout life. We know that the better educated you are, the less at risk of dementia you are in later life. And keeping intellectually active is very important, but also keeping physically active, getting regular aerobic exercise, and also getting some regular strength training, resistance exercise is very important.
And I know you're a big advocate, as almost everyone who comes on this programme is, for the simple act of walking and what that does to our brains. I have another one for you, and I'm wondering, can you answer this one? Shane, is there a link, one listener asked between, is it hypothyroid and dementia?
Unproven is probably the best thing to say. And there are plenty of treatments for hypothyroidism, and people usually respond. Now, I'm not a medic, so I'm not offering a particular course of treatment here, but people respond well to treatment for hypothyroidism, and they should expect to have normal cognitive function.
When we look at those figures from Alzheimer's Disease International, you know, someone in the world develops dementia every 3 seconds. This is an issue that's going to resonate with many of our listeners, many of us who have already experienced in our families and perhaps in our wider circle of family and friends, people who have been diagnosed with these conditions, and often in very many cases early onset versions of this.
Yeah, so, you know, we're undertaking a kind of an experiment on the planet that is absolutely unprecedented. You know, if you go back 200 years, your average life expectancy was, you know, if you got to your 40s or 50s, you were doing quite well. Yeah. And now a life expectancy, you know, here in Ireland, it's not trumpeted enough, but it should be. Our life expectancy is the highest in the EU at the moment, which I think is really, really quite something. You know, you only have to go back to the 1960s to see average ages of death in the high 60s and the low 70s. And now people can comfortably expect to live to the low 80s, if not the mid 80s or beyond. so that we are actually changing the demography of the planet. I think this is positive. I think more years of life is better than less years of life on average. But we need to design our societies around this idea that we should be engaged in lifelong activity, lifelong learning, lifelong engagement with each other, so that we ensure that people aren't socially isolated and all of those other things that we can do something about.
Shane, we're going to have to get you back on again because there's actually so many questions coming in about cognitive function, whether it's through diet or exercise. And I know some good news actually earlier this week. I think that there is a new drug or a new set of drugs that are coming on board that may be able to tackle
what is... Yes, lecanemab has just been approved in the US, and it's the first, I think, really positive signal. It doesn't prevent the progression of Alzheimer's permanently, but it arrests it at least for a 5 or 6 month period. And it's the first kind of positive signal that has come, because there has been billions spent on hundreds of drug trials over the last 30 years in this area. And at least now there's a positive message coming through.
Absolutely. Well, I think it is affecting lots of people based on the questions that are coming in. We will have to get you back in again. But until then, you can sign up to Professor Shane O'Mara's Substack if you head to brainpizza.substack.com. That's brainpizza.substack.com. Shane O'Mara, Professor of Experimental Brain Research at the School of Psychology and Institute of Neuroscience in Trinity. Thank you very, very much for joining us today. We're going to take a quick break.
Email brendan@rte.ie.